Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Welcome to Money for the Rest of Us. This is a personal finance show. It's on money, how it works, how to invest it, and how to live without worrying about it. I'm your host, David Stein. Today is episode 200, and it's titled The Great National Debt Debate. 200 episodes, been just about 4 years. We have 200 numbered regular episodes. There was some holiday specials, so we're a little bit over 200, but it has been the most enjoyable thing to interact with you. LaPrelle and I have been on a road trip for the last 90 days. We've had a number of listener meetups. And one of the things that we've done on this trip is meet with podcasters that I know. And one of those podcasters will join me today in this week's episode. We're currently staying in Palm Beach County on Riviera Beach. And Joshua Sheets of Radical Personal Finance has stopped by yesterday, and we discussed the national debt. Joshua did a show last summer. I was out biking, and I happened to be listening to an episode that he did. It was episode 466 on the national debt, and he was really, really concerned about it. And I wrote him an email and told him why he shouldn't be so worried. And we decided that it would be best to have that conversation in person. So Joshua came over yesterday to the condo where we're staying, and we had the discussion, and that is what is on this episode. But before we get to that, I just want to thank you for listening to the show, for sharing it with your friends and family members. Money for the Rest of Us has just about 7 million downloads, probably a little more than 7 million. I've switched podcast host. It's kind of hard sometimes with the stats to see exactly how accurate they are, but appears to be roughly 7 million downloads. 75% of the audience is based in the U.S., 25% in non-U.S. The top countries are the U.S., obviously, followed by Canada, Australia, United Kingdom, Germany, and India. And the top cities are New York, Los Angeles, San Francisco, Washington, Chicago, Seattle. Top five states, California, Texas, New York, Florida, Illinois, and Washington. Thanks again for listening to the show. And with that, let's have this discussion with Joshua regarding the national debt. We touch on certainly balance sheet issues, but the conversation talks about cultural issues, politics, political issues, tribalism. And then we stop. I'm used to doing a 30-minute show. If you listen to Joshua's show, he doesn't have a hard stop when he does his shows. And so we stopped recording after about 35 minutes. But we weren't quite done. And so we started recording again for another 10 minutes. So there's a break there at about the 35, 37-minute mark, and then we start again. I hope you enjoy this episode.
David Stein, welcome back to Radical Personal Finance.
It's good to be here.
So a number of months ago, I recorded a show talking about the future of basically the U.S. government economic situation, the fiscal situation. And in that show, I talked extensively about Lawrence Kotlikoff's discussion of the unfunded liabilities of the U.S. government. And I started the process of declaring my position on the unsustainability of current U.S. government and fiscal policies. It's my personal opinion that the U.S. government and the U.S. American culture is effectively bankrupt, and that the process of that bankruptcy will proceed forward over the coming decades. I don't know a time, but it'll take over the coming decades. We'll see that bankruptcy more and more become apparent, the great default, as some people have termed it. Now, after that show, you emailed me and you said, Joshua, I don't agree with you. And in that email, you said, let's talk about it. So here we are, months too late, but we're finally getting back to talking about it. So what I thought would be fun is, let me, in short, describe my understanding. And I want to keep today's show free of a lot of numbers and detail. That's better discussed in writing. But I'll very briefly describe my position, and then I want to hear your position and hear what you believe and don't believe. It seems to me that if I do an analysis of the last century of U.S. American spending and government policy, it seems like we have made commitments on the level of government that we will never be able to keep. Most importantly, Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security, or I guess I should reverse that order, Medicaid, Medicare, and Social Security, are effectively bankrupt. They don't have enough money to cash the promises that they have made. And so over the coming decades, I expect those to be, over time, defaulted on in a myriad of ways. And I look at the political situation in the United States, and I see no possibility, I see no political impetus, I see no one who's standing and saying, let's stop borrowing money, let's pay our bills, let's actually balance our budget, let's actually figure out how to run on the money that we take in, let's figure out how to adjust taxes and revenue so they're at least equal, let alone pay off debt. What do you think?
Well, I think it gets back to what is money. In other words, a lot of the analogies, the U.S. is like a business or a household. So it has constraints.
Right.
But it doesn't. The government's money, essentially it's magic money. Money is digital.
Right.
And so when we look at what happens when the government spends, it's not, doesn't have to sit there and wait for this money to show up. And so when you go back to what Kotlikoff, in his generational accounting, he's looking at all these promised payments, and he discounts them into today's dollars, and he looks at the potential tax revenue,
right,
and discounts it today's dollar, and there's this huge fiscal gap.
Right.
But the U.S. government has run a deficit basically forever,
right,
since it's been around. And if, think about it in terms of monopoly money. If it was just monopoly money, we wouldn't have these things. So while I might agree with you that there's some fundamental decline in the U.S. government, mm-hmm, I don't think there's not a fiscal constraint, and we have examples of that. We have Japan that has much greater debt to GDP than the U.S. But what do you have happening? You have the Japanese central bank effectively buying that national debt. They now own 40%. They've bought it out of money they created out of thin air. But that doesn't mean there's no constraints. And that's where I think it's the key. It's not that the government can spend as much as it wants, because the wealth of a country is the ability of the private sector to produce in goods and services that we can eat. And so if a government like Venezuela is spending ridiculous amounts of money and buying off its population, yet has destroyed the private sector, then you have massive inflation. Because you have essentially a collapsing economy, there's not enough food, the government's spending money, and you have hyperinflation. But in an economy like the U.S., where you have a robust private sector, and our deficits are small relative to the size of the economy, we can continue indefinitely like we've been doing and have done for centuries. And it's not going to be a collapse based on accounting. If there's going to be a collapse, it's going to be based on a morally bankrupt government that doesn't follow the rule of law.
So interestingly, I just have been reading, I'm late to the party, I've been aware of it for a time, but I've just been reading David Stockman's book, The Great Deformation. Are you familiar with that book or ever read it?
I am, and I don't necessarily agree with him either.
Right. So I know a lot of people, he's a very, of course, divisive figure.
But I've not read the book. Right, I've read reviews. I might have started it. And
I'm only partway into it, but it's in something I've been really grappling with this question. And he lays out a very strong case that in the 2008 financial collapse, that the moral connection between the natural free market system and the government getting involved, that that moral connection was broken. And he makes a very strong case that all of the governmental intervention was unnecessary. Now, I also read the official U.S. Report that was issued by the inquiry into the financial collapse. And of course, they would disagree with one another. So the moral dimension is one thing, but let's stick with the finance.
I agree. Go ahead. I don't think the government should have intervened.
Right. Okay.
How they do.
So we're agreed.
I don't
that.
Necessarily agree that the Federal Reserve should be creating money.
Right.
As part of the quantitative easing program. I don't think that was necessary. But that's separate from the fact that they can.
Right. So I think I have to acknowledge, and I want to acknowledge, that for all of the talk of doomsday and collapse that we've seen people talk about for decades, it hasn't happened yet. So those who say it's inevitable have to reconcile, well, it hasn't happened yet. And lots of people have said it was inevitable long ago. But do you think there is a limit with regard to deficit spending? Do you think there is a limit? And if there is, what would it be? Because after I recorded that show, I had a listener who seemed very well informed write to me and said, Joshua, you're wrong. And you're wrong because you think that there's a limit. And we've proven that there effectively is no limit on government spending. And what you need to do is read this, which demonstrate that there's no limit. The government continue to do this because, as you say, the government controls the monetary supply. They can print more money. They can always satisfy their obligations because there is effectively no limit.
And the limit is the ability of the private sector to produce. You're seeing Venezuela as a country where they've met their limit. They have impeded the ability of farmers to grow crops. They don't have enough food.
Right.
And it didn't matter that the government can create money out of thin air. It can create cryptocurrencies.
Right.
Because there isn't enough to eat. And so that's the fundamental limit. Where there's not a limit, and oftentimes people, you'll see articles that don't understand how the monetary system works, will say, well, our grandchildren are going to have to pay for this debt that we've incurred. Now, think about that. Has anybody come to you from your great-great-grandparents asking for the debt that the government took on in the beginning of the century?
I would say yes, but in this way, that a significant portion of the federal expenditure, I don't have the number in front of me, but I would say, 15-20% of the federal expenditure is currently spent on interest. No, it would be less than that. Interest on the federal debt, right? And that debt has accumulated since World War II. So we are still currently paying interest.
We pay interest on it, right. But nobody's collected it. Because what is government debt? It's assets of most of us. In other words, that interest flows right back into the economy and it becomes income. And you always have to look at who's on the other side of the balance sheet.
Right.
Government debt are households' assets. And what is creating that debt each year? Because one of the things people talk about, we need to have a balanced budget.
Right.
Well, the government can set what they want to spend. They really don't have control over the revenue because that is determined by the decisions of households and businesses, how much they want to save. And let me just give a brief example. Just think of if businesses and households decide that they want to save more, that means they spend less. And if they spend less, then they're buying less from other households and businesses, which means their income drops, which ultimately means that there's less tax revenue. Because if people are trying to save more, and businesses are trying to save more by spending less, then other businesses aren't going to have as much income. People aren't going to have many jobs, so there'll be less tax revenue. And that naturally puts the government into a deficit position. Even if the budget was balanced at the beginning of the year, we're going to spend whatever, $5 trillion here, and we hope to get $5 trillion in revenue. As soon as the household and business sector decide they don't want to spend as much, then the revenue drops, the tax revenue. And that's why we naturally have bigger deficits during times of recession because of unemployment benefits. But it's ultimately the fiscal situation of the federal government is determined by households and businesses, assuming that the government isn't out of control in terms of its spending. I mean, there has to be some basic understanding, as we're not going to be like Venezuela, right? And if we don't have that, then we're in trouble.
Well, and I used to have optimism that perhaps somebody, especially the Republicans who ran on the idea that we're going to be fiscally constrained, I used to have optimism that the Republicans might follow through at some point. But with this recent, what I would term a boondoggle, with this recent boondoggle of a tax bill a few months ago and spending bill that was passed by Republican-controlled Congress and Senate and signed by a Republican president, I have lost any optimism that there's any serious politician, with the exception of maybe Rand Paul, who staged some theatrical objections. But it seems like there's almost nobody who actually stands for fiscal constraint. So I've lost that optimism. But let me go back. Let's talk about cost.
Well, hang on. But I don't. Yes, but I don't think they're out of control. In other words, we could run a 3-4% deficit to GDP indefinitely. We've done it, and it's been done. And it goes back to showing when is the collapse going to occur from a fiscal standpoint. Japan has twice as much debt to GDP as the U.S. So 240% debt to GDP. We're about 103%. And Japan is doing just fine and doesn't have issues with inflation because their population is shrinking. And so, again, the constraint is there enough people to produce the goods and services? And it'll be interesting to see, because Japan will get into trouble way, way sooner than the U.S. If there is a constraint, Japan is going to get in trouble. But right now, it's just not there.
Okay. So here's the point, though. The numbers that you're referencing are on-book liabilities, the official federal debt as is calculated, which is, what, 20 trillion in ish,
yeah, 20 trillion.
About 20 trillion. Whereas what Kotlikoff's point is the unfunded liabilities, which in his estimation, depending on the year of his work, range anywhere from 180 to $200 trillion. And what he's describing there is the commitments, the promises that are made to the recipients of Medicaid, Medicare, and Social Security that are not accounted for in official on-budget debt. And so here's where, in my guess, after I've spent about a decade kind of thinking about this, and a decade ago when I started to think about it, I said I had this impression that, well, one day the federal government's just going to run out of money and they're not going to – that's not possible unless you have a society in anarchy, because the power behind the U.S. dollar as a made-up currency without any fundamental connection to anything constraining, the power is the taxing authority of the entity and of the state behind it, and the state's ability to use force to enforce their taxation. And so on that basis, the U.S. government can always write any number of checks that they want, because they have the monopoly or the majority of force, and so they can force tax revenue and they can just write checks. But the problem is, what are those checks worth when they actually get there? And so I don't see any way that all of a sudden that all of the hoopla over government shutdowns notwithstanding, which is just, in my mind, political theater, I don't think that at some point in time you just stop. That the U.S. government stops writing checks. But I do think that the value of what is promised continually constricts. And it goes back to the world of financial planning. What did I tell when I was working as a financial planner? What did I tell all of my younger clients? And it was this is standard in the world of professional financial planning. Don't plan on Social Security. Now, that's just the tip of the iceberg, because Social Security is one of the healthier ones. When you go to Medicare and Medicaid and you look at the numbers that are required, there's no way that I don't see any way that those promises can be fulfilled. And that's what I refer to as default.
Well, first off, my issue with Kotlikoff is it takes everything from the future and puts it in the present. We do this year by year. So 5 years from now, when it comes to Social Security and Medicare, the government can create the money. I think we at least agree on that.
I agree.
The issue is, will it be any doctors or hospitals to service the retirees that are sick? And that's the constraint. If they've created money and there's not enough doctors because everybody's retired, then we're going to have inflation. But through advances in artificial intelligence, robotics, just productivity increases, if there is a private sector that can – it's a question of accounting. Like, get the money to the retirees so they can pay the doctors that are there. Now, if the doctors already have too much business and there's not enough doctors, then you have inflation. That's the constraint. The constraint isn't the accounting. And a great example. So I used to have one of my clients as an institutional advisor was a retirement home. And they had a $30 million portfolio. But they also had financial statements. So every year in their financial statements, they would have their fees that they collect. But a big portion was realized gains. And then they would have their expenses. So they had their wealth, which was their actual investments. But they had their financial statements. And I remember one year, the CFO came to me and said, we don't have enough gains because my financial statement shows we're losing money. Yet their portfolio was up that year. And so I suggested, well, we could sell some stocks and realize the gains from an accounting perspective. And she's like, no, we can't churn the portfolio. But in fact, that's what she wanted. She wanted her accounting statement to look better fiscally when their wealth over here was their actual investment assets with a ton of unrealized gains. It's the same with this type of generational accounting. The balance sheet looks terrible. The government has always been insolvent because it always spends more money than it receives. The issue is the wealth. The wealth are the people and the households, the businesses. Will they be able to supply enough goods and services, including medical treatment, for the populace? We can take care of the accounting issues, getting the money from whatever, other people. But if we don't have the capacity to produce, then we're in trouble.
So for the sake of argument, let me grant your point. Let's assume that accounting doesn't matter, because I concur with your point. Somebody who has a failing business and mountains of debt isn't necessarily doomed to guaranteed bankruptcy.
Well, they can't create money either.
That's correct, which is always the government has a monopoly on money creation and on force to extract tax revenue. But let's go then back to a realistic accounting of the future, because those financial decisions are predicated upon the productivity of the sector, the health of the economy. And I would dissent with your point that the government has always been insolvent, the U.S. government. I don't see that in history. It seems as though there have been times of insolvency, you know, right after the Revolutionary War, the early U.S.-American government inflated like crazy, but it's gone through periods. But for the last, say, first quarter of the 20th century, there has been this continual trend towards increasing levels of debt, increasing promises, et cetera.
Because it loses money every year. I mean, when I say insolvent, I'm saying they're
right.
Like most businesses cannot lose money every single year.
Right.
I mean, they're effectively insolvent. The government can, but by some definitions, it would be insolvent.
So now let's talk about cultural capital. And I'm so torn on these issues because on the one hand, I can't deny that Wall Street, for the sake of using a very collectivized term, Wall Street has been deeply productive with their assets. Wealth is growing. But I don't see the same strength reflected in the U.S.-American culture. I see a very sick U.S.-American culture, and I'm concerned with the idea that there is enough cultural capital to sustain through for decades.
What do you think?
Oh,
exactly. And I've talked a lot about some of those issues on my show in terms of income inequality, just the state of education, just the state of ethics. Because money is trust.
Right.
And if we no longer have trust as a society, if we don't trust our neighbors, if we don't trust businesses, if we don't trust government, then you're right. We're in serious trouble. But what bugs me is the focus doesn't get put on that. It gets put on the government's balance sheet. And we get into this, we need to balance the budget. Why don't we focus, why don't we understand what money is? And understand, since we're no longer on the gold standard,
right,
that we can create as much money as we want. Why don't we make sure we have policies that assure that decades down the road, we have a functioning private sector, a productive private sector, an educated private sector? That's what worries me. Not accounting issues regarding how money's created, et cetera. Because all the evidence shows to date that between the central bank and the U.S. government, the money can be created. What's not clear is whether hopefully the private sector will still function in the decades down the road. But we can take it year by year and hopefully solve these issues, but not get distracted by this sideshow of the national debt.
Let's take a break from this conversation with Joshua to hear some words from this week's sponsors.
If you've been using Mint to manage your finances, you know they shut down several months ago. Well, let me tell you about the budgeting solution, the financial tracking solution I've been using for the past number of months. It's Monarch Money. Monarch Money is the top-rated all-in-one personal finance app. It gives you a comprehensive view of all your accounts, investments, transactions, and more. You can create custom budgets like I've done. You can set goals, collaborate with your partner. And now you can get an extended 30-day free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/David. What I like about Monarch is the ability to customize what I want to see. I have custom budget categories, and then I can go on to the dashboard and see where I'm above trend on some of my spending. I especially like that Monarch will never sell your data to third parties or show you ads. After trying Monarch myself, I understand why it's the top-rated personal finance app. And right now, get an extended 30-day free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/David. That's monarchmoney.com/David for your extended 30-day free trial. We have a brand new sponsor to our show. It's Yahoo Finance. Yahoo's been around for decades. My first email outside of work was a Yahoo email address. But the financial side, I've used on occasion primarily to get data for dividend histories for particular funds or ETFs. But I was pleasantly surprised to get back on Yahoo Finance to see how it's evolved over the years. Now it's really a financial dashboard where you can get an understanding of what's going on with the markets. There are relevant articles from Bloomberg, Reuters, the Associated Press, and the Yahoo Finance team. You can look at the economic events calendar and see which data series are being released that day and what the consensus is. You can see the pulse of the markets at any time by going to Yahoo Finance. In addition, you could see all of your investments and retirement accounts in one place with Yahoo Finance. You get a consolidated view of multiple accounts. Yahoo Finance serves as a financial hub for your retirement accounts, but also comprehensive financial news and analysis. You need to check out Yahoo Finance, particularly if you haven't been there in a while. Check it out at yahoofinance.com. That's yahoofinance.com.
So where do you see reasons for optimism at the moment?
I am really excited by the... First off, I think people are fundamentally good. I mean, I've been traveling for 3 months, or I guess a month and a half now. And people are good. And they want good things. And a lot of people are trying. And we certainly have problems, but I think by and large, society are good people trying to do the best for their families. That's a positive. I think the flexibility, the freedom we still have to start businesses here. And we don't have, people complain about red tape, but it's so much easier to start a business here in Cuba, where they've effectively outlawed any private business other than running a restaurant, running out a house in a room in your house, and driving a taxi, right? That's it. Here we have that flexibility. I think the advances in robotics, in artificial intelligence, our ability to produce goods and services is growing dramatically. Now that's creating potentially unemployment problems to where we might have everything we need, but nobody has a job. because we can create so much. That's a potential issue. That we're, again, that's an accounting issue. Again, how do we get money to the people? But if we have the goods and services, and that's what, then I'm optimistic about that.
So I'll give you my list, and then I'll ask for your list of what you're concerned about. My list would be, number one, I'm encouraged by the decentralization of information. I'm encouraged that now a 10-year-old child in the poorest neighborhood or of the United States or even the world can access the knowledge of the world through a $40 smartphone. And I'm deeply encouraged about that. I'm encouraged about the decentralization of education and schooling. I think that by the leader, for example, Salman Khan with the Khan Academy, I think that he is the harbinger of just a massive change in education. I don't live in kind of mainstream circles, but I hardly know any young couples who are parents who are sending their children to government schools. Almost everybody is looking for other alternatives, and I see that as a great opportunity for children to be trained, and instead of being stultified and dumbed down by the monopoly on education, I see that as positive. I agree with you as far as the ability to start businesses. I still live in the United States of America simply because I don't know anywhere better. If there were better, I would go, but I don't know anywhere better. And it is much easier to start businesses in the United States than that. So I agree with you on those things, and I see that it's never been easier to meet the basic needs of a person or a family, of shelter over their head, of food in their belly it's never been easier than it is today. And I'm very enthusiastic about some of the advances in being able to shelter and feed people using robotic and AI technology to grow crops locally within the city using very calculated computer controlled systems, or to 3D print houses for people for $5,000 that are safe and comfortable and warm. So I'm very motivated and optimistic about those trends, and just the increasing ability for individuals to connect with other individuals. So I do see those things as positive. What are you concerned about? What trends do you see that keep you up at night?
I'm concerned about tribalism, people breaking down into groups. And one of the things I hate when people say they should do this or they should do that, as opposed to we should solve this together. So the strife, the just how mad people get.
Right.
It's not, in politics, for example, it's not enough to disagree.
Right.
They hate the other side.
Right.
And that terrifies me. It really does. The lack of ethics. The corporations that knowingly pass on costs to innocent, negative externalities, and just lie. I mean, that will destroy a country. And so on one hand, I go around and I think people are basically good, but I think people get selfish and they forget. They don't think about the consequences of some of their actions sometimes, particularly in business. So, but I think generally speaking, things are better done on the local level. And I've talked about that on my show. I worry about bureaucracy, big government and things of that sort. I think there's some things, because the government actually has the power to create money, there's some things better for the government to finance, but then have it implemented at the local level. If we get to the point where everything's created very easily for what we need, but people don't have enough jobs, then I think the solution is not to have the federal government hire a bunch of people, but finance businesses, give them grants to hire people to go visit the elderly or things like that. I mean, but it needs to be done at the local level. But those are my concerns. I think it's just a lack of integrity concerns me. The breaking down into tribes, income equality concerns me. when businesses, all they care about is profit, so they don't pay their workers enough. And ultimately, and it shouldn't be the government mandates it. I'm saying as a business, we shouldn't be short-sighted. We should pay our people fairly. Now, it's hard to figure out. Business is hard.
Yeah.
It concerns me that businesses generally, it's easier to buy back stock, which is one of the things driving the stock market.
Correct.
Right. As opposed to investing in the future and investing in their people. Again, there's always a balance. But it's easier to buy back stock as a CEO. You get the immediate impact. You don't have the uncertainty of other areas. Well, I mean, those are a few of my concerns. Yeah. But generally, I'm optimistic. And I think these are issues we can solve.
I'll give you just a few of mine. Obviously, this is not comprehensive. But a few of mine would be, I agree with you. I concur with you about the lack of ethics. We've lost, as the United States of America moves into what seems to be, under current understanding, what seems to be a post-Christian era, we've lost a common ability to talk about ethics, where we all affirm the existence of a moral standard, but we dissent about what moral standard there is. And so different people view things differently on discussion of something like minimum wage, right? You have two people. One person says, you must mandate a minimum wage because that's morally right. Another person, I would say, you must not mandate a minimum wage because that's morally wrong. Not that you shouldn't pay someone, but that's a use of coercion and force. And so I see this continually as we've lost the ability to discuss things within a frame where we can find common understanding, and we lack a common discussion of ethics,
and I agree with that.
Yeah, and right. we don't teach ethics. Because of this concern, we don't teach formally ethics. We do in some places. I went through when I was getting my master's degree in financial planning. One of the capstone courses was a discussion of ethics, and it was drawn from an entirely secular perspective. And the philosophy professor who was leading that charge, I asked her. I said, "What is the basis for these ethical issues? And how do you know what is right in the situation? What is right in this financial planning situation? What is right for this company? How do you reason from this?" And since there's no agreement on those first principles, the application of it becomes different. I'm concerned about I agree with you about tribalism, and I see it as so dangerous because, especially in the United States of America, and from my assessment, we've lost we've lost a majority of our common cultural understanding. I don't feel almost any connection to somebody who is a U.S. American. Just because somebody's an American, I don't feel any kind of national pride or national sense of identity with them. I feel that sense of connection to people who are outside of that, but I often feel more culturally connected to somebody who shares more of my worldview, who's of another skin color from another continent, than I do of my neighbor, because there doesn't seem to be that historical identity that's being passed on. And I don't know how a nation continues to function if it doesn't have a common heritage, a common creed that is passed on from generation to generation. I've lost that myself. I feel very little connection to the neighbor and to my neighbors. And then increasingly, there doesn't seem to be much outworking of that sense of community. The communities are tend to be siloed and not geographic in nature, but ideological in nature. And without belaboring the point, it's hard for me to find a whole lot of examples where things are really flourishing, where people are really feeling good, where people are working towards common progress. I'm sure they exist, just
I think they do. But I think the key is just go out and meet people. I mean, yeah, I'm sure you do it, right? But
right.
Meet your neighbors, reach out, be human. I do think as a nation, we have a common set of values, freedom, entrepreneurialism, et cetera. I think other nations do too. But one of the things that does concern me is where America's the greatest country in the world is what politicians say. Well, you know, there's a lot of great places.
Right.
And there's a lot of amazingly good people everywhere. And I just need to be kinder to the people and connect more with people And I think that's one thing the internet has done, is to allow sort of that common language, that common connectivity. And while we might have some of these moral discussions, minimum wage, et cetera, if we get to the point where we just straight out steal and that becomes accepted, that's the problem.
We already are. And here's my argument there. We already are there. So half of the population says those other people shouldn't have it, so we're going to take from them to give to these people. I call that theft. Now, it's theft by majority vote, but that is theft. And so certainly, is it different than me going and pilfering the stapler from my boss's office? In a sense, but at its fundamental basis, it's no different. So you talk about this heritage of freedom. I don't see it. Maybe it's a generational thing, but I don't see a lot of people. I don't hear a lot of people talking about, I affirm your right to individual freedom. It feels to me, speaking very subjectively, it feels to me like a lot of people want to say, no, you don't have the freedom to do this. No, you don't have the freedom to do that. You want to start a business cutting hair? Yeah, you have to go and apply for a license. You want to go and move into this occupation? You need to go and ask for a license. It's a constant stricture on freedom. So I disagree and dissent. We don't have a common heritage of freedom. We talk about it. We talk about defending freedom, but there is no, I don't see the common heritage.
Those are issues on the margin. You can still, even if you have to get the license, we can talk about the amount of regulation you need to cut people's hair. You can't do that in Cuba.
You can do it until you get reported and until the government goons start knocking on your door and say, are you cutting hair illegally? I have been in meetings with people. One lady was a client of mine. I don't know how she ended up as a client of mine. She was cutting hair in her living room in the inner city and been doing that until she got the knock on the door from the government goons saying, we heard that you're doing unauthorized business activities here. We're a lot closer to Cuba than we once were. That's what I see.
Well, we probably are. And that's a different discussion in terms of how much regulation there should be. I mean, you and I have talked about your inability to have chickens here in Palm Beach County.
Right.
And you've talked about it on your show. But yes. But those are issues regarding policy and the limits. At the end of the day, though, this theft that you discuss, again, the government can create the money, right? They're not really taking money from you and giving it to somebody else. They're taking money from us because we have taxes. Then the other hand is creating the money to spend. And we have to come together in terms of how much should they spend and what they should spend it on and the amount of policy. But coming full circle, those are issues other than the accounting of what the national debt is. I think that's sustainable for many years in the future, but we take it one year at a time.
So my closing question for you, do you affirm that it's possible that there would be various forms of default, bankruptcy, and collapse in coming decades? And if it were possible, what would you look for?
I would look for just complete lack of honesty with our leaders. The government's been taken over by, it be it the private, private businesses or whatever, just right. You can tell. I mean, I don't think we're there yet. We're still arguing about what the money should be spent on, but we are a far cry from, I'll give the example of Venezuela, where the government is threatening their citizens that you have to vote for me or we will not give you your food stipend because they're starving. We're not even close to that yet. And for that, I'm fortunate, but we could get there, and that's why we have to be involved as citizens in terms of who's elected. And at the local level, get involved locally and get out and meet our fellow citizens. And don't just stay indoors in our gated communities.
So I affirm that I could be wrong, and I hope that I am. We're certainly not in Venezuela, but I hope that all of us can work together to avoid that fate. Thank you for coming on.
Hey, it was fun.
That was 37 minutes. So I turned the recorder back on because I just want to hear this. So we got that time pressure off. that the issue that I face, and I'm asking this sincerely, is how old are you now?
53.
Okay, so you're about 20 years older than I am, and you've been involved in a similar path as I have in terms of the financial world. I don't want to be a catastrophist or an alarmist. I don't want to, scream that the sky is falling when the sky is not falling, which is why I'm very sensitive to the people who make foolish decisions and say, well, you know, by 2010, the world's going to collapse and the U.S. dollar is going to be worth. I think those things are so overblown and overstable.
Like, the U.S. dollar, they're selling a newsletter.
Yeah. The U.S. dollar is the strongest currency in the world. Right? But I also don't want to just be a Pollyanna where everything is perfect, because I see throughout history a systematic ebb and flow of growth and decline. Empires collapse. They do collapse. And so just because somebody has said it will collapse and it hasn't yet doesn't mean that it's necessarily not going to collapse. And I think back to the question of freedom, I hear almost nobody advocating for freedom. I don't hear, and I know I think political leaders are important because they reflect the population to the extent that anybody can reflect the population. I don't reflect the population. I'm a voice crying in the wilderness, you know, just kind of saying what I think is right. But a politician needs to appeal to people's, to a larger branch to get elected if a democratic action works as it's supposed to. So a politician is going to reflect the culture. Tell me who you hear talking about and advocating for freedom as a fundamental principle of U.S. American society.
Well, I guess it depends on your definition for freedom. I think that
you choose the definition. Just tell me who. Like, and I'm not being snarky with you, but you, I don't care about the definition. But what would you define as freedom, or any definition you want? I guess
the ability to get up and provide for my family. And go where I want to go. And within reason, do what I want to do without necessarily impeding or putting harm on others. I think we have that. And so I think it's more a question of degrees. Maybe we don't have as much freedom as we would like, and we can argue about laws and regulations, etc. But as I've traveled around the world, we have so much more freedom than we have plenty of freedom.
Right.
And I mean, you and I have talked about zoning issues, right?
Right.
Well, I mean, governments overstep their bounds because I've seen this at the local level, right? At the local level, it's amazing how much influence you can have at the local level. To the extent that they've outlawed chickens in Palm Beach County, but they used to outlaw chickens in Rexburg, Idaho. Well, the citizens came together and said, you know, there's a lot more places in the U.S. where you can have chickens in cities now than there were 20 years ago.
Right.
Because as citizens, we decided we want that freedom at our local community to have fresh eggs. And so I think, I mean, that's an example where freedom's gone the other way,
right,
despite where we are. And so I do think, I don't feel constricted day to day in terms of what I can do. I really don't. You started Radical Personal Finance. I started Money for the Rest of Us. Nobody said you couldn't do that. Many places, they would have. And so that's a freedom. That's a huge freedom we have today that we didn't have 30 years ago. Everybody can create their own content, have their own radio station in terms of a podcast. That's a huge freedom.
So I affirm that the United States of America enjoys more of these freedoms than in most places in the world. I affirm that. As I've traveled, every time I leave the country, I'm just so thankful for the opportunities. I think, and I've said this on the show many times, it's been a while since I've been outside the borders, so maybe it's time to take my own advice. But if you're feeling downcast about your possibilities that you have in life, get on an airplane and go somewhere else, and you'll be thankful for your job. My wife and I, on our honeymoon, we traveled to Haiti, and that's just off the shores of Florida. I always come back from these places just thankful that I can have a job, that I can work, that I can do it. Because when you're in a world where 75% of people can't even get a job, who want a job, it's so broken that you're thankful for the ability to go and get any menial job whatsoever in the United States of America. And perhaps I am prone to thinking like an ideologue, but I just look at something as simple as work freedom, as freedom. A majority, seemingly, a significant percentage of the population believes that it's I have a number of friends who are immigrants to the United States of America, and most of them, with a couple from different countries, a couple of them are out of compliance status with the United States in terms of immigration law. Several of them are in compliance with the United States in terms of immigration law. But I am so frustrated at the idea that the U.S. government thinks that it has the moral authority and right to tell a person, no, you can't work for, no, you can't go and do honest, productive work to provide for your family because you haven't applied for the proper paperwork, or that the U.S. government would have the temerity to think that it can say to an employer, no, you have you can't hire this person because they don't have the appropriate visa requirements to do honest work that you need them to do. Now, maybe I'm in a...
Now, what's fascinating about that, right? Because that I agree with you. And that, which is why this is a great conversation, that's not a conservative position.
No, no. And this is my frustration with... This is what I am fed up with the political world. Because it's like every about 50 years... The Democrats and the Republicans basically swap places and take each other's positions about every 50 years. And that's what frustrates me, because I've not heard of a Republican position. I've not heard of a Republican maybe there are. I don't hear a Republican politician affirming somebody's right to work. Now flip it around. Let's just pick on the Democrats. So we pick on everybody and annoy every listener. On the same hand, there are lots of Democrats and Democratic politicians who say, you should be able to hire somebody regardless of their immigration status, but we're going to require you, at the threat of force, to pay them $15 an hour, whether the work that they're doing for you is worth $15 an hour or not. And so I deny both of those premises. Mm. I affirm the fact that any person should be able to make any other private contract with any other person, as long as the work is moral and ethical and legal, as long as those things are there, without interference. That's freedom. But
I agree. I don't hear
anybody affirming that. And so when you talk about freedom, yes, we do have freedom, but I look at it and say, is this not an inheritance from centuries of work that are unique to the U.S. American experiment? Because the early colonists of the United States were desperately longing for freedom. They were seeking religious freedom. And now I find myself as a religious minority with much of my religious freedom diminished, and what religious freedom I do enjoy banished to the idea of private practice, as long as it's not public or as long as it has no effect on your actual life. And so I look at that and say that the heritage was freedom, but where is the continuing press towards freedom? I don't see it. All I see is a continual stricture. Now, compared to the rest of the world, absolutely, it's there. But I don't see that change.
No, and I agree with that. I think religious freedom... There's less of it than it was. And I don't know.
And so I use this as evidence for my position that this common – I don't think – we don't speak a common understanding. Like I don't hear those common ideas reflected in U.S. American culture. I hear the platitudes of, you know, we live for freedom, fight for freedom, et cetera. You know, we all inherit the freedom that people have died for. I hear the platitudes, but I don't see much of the results. Much of the freedom seems to me to be enlarged by individuals, but largely by individuals who, with technological changes, you know, there are tremendous freedoms. That's why I stated those things, like the destruction of the monopoly on the press. I love that. I'm thrilled with it. Now, it's very uncomfortable, right? You got to deal with fake news and all this stuff, but it is a good thing for freedom. And I'm the inherent, in, for example, home education, just simple things. Like I was born at home. When I was born, in a time when home birth was not particularly officially sanctioned. I was homeschooled at a time when home education was not officially sanctioned. It was very much a gray area. Whereas today, it's relatively easy for anybody who wants to take control of those things to do it. But I don't hear that common conversation. So I'm ranting and raving, and I don't know what my point is, so I'll let you say something.
Well, I wrap up. Get on the road like you plan on doing,
right?
and travel around, and come to Idaho. There's a lot of freedom out in Idaho.
Indeed. Thanks, David.
So that's episode 200. Hope you enjoyed that. Earlier, I mentioned we'd been on the road for 90 days. It's only been about 50 days. We, frankly, I'm losing track of time. Also, you can get show notes at moneyfortherestofus.com. And while you're there, sign up for my free insider's guide. I indeed do a separate essay every single week that doesn't necessarily cover that week's topic. So things that I've covered in recent weeks, we talked about how big indexing has gotten, provided an update on that. We took a closer look at the steel industry, the amount of jobs leaving the steel industry in light of the tariff situation that we talked about a few weeks ago. I did an essay on socialism versus capitalism. So some of my best writing is in that weekly free insider's guide email. That's the only place that you can get that additional content. And you can sign up for that at moneyfortherestofus.com. Or if you're a U.S.-based listener, just text the word insider to the number 44222. Everything I've shared with you in this episode has been for general education. I've not considered your specific risk situation. No, not providing investment advice here. Just general education on money, investing in the economy. Thanks again for being a listener to Money for the Rest of Us. We've done 200 episodes. I have no intention of stopping, so I look forward to the next 200. Have a great week.